A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about the architecture of the sky, how the whole system of civil aviation we take for granted didn't just emerge naturally. It was built on military foundations, then deliberately separated out. The turning point he's zeroing in on is the Chicago Convention of 1944 and the creation of ICAO, the moment the world drew a formal line between civilian and military aviation. His question is how we got from the Wright brothers to that bifurcated system and how integral that civil-military distinction has been to everything aviation became.
The thing that jumps out immediately is that the first flight in 1903 was a civilian affair. The Wright brothers were bicycle mechanics running a print shop, private inventors, not military contractors. They actually pitched the War Department first and got turned down. The U.S. Army didn't sign a contract with them until 1908.
So the military was late to the party.
By about 5 years, yeah. But once they showed up, they brought money, real money, and the whole center of gravity shifted. Within a decade of Kitty Hawk, every major power was pouring funds into military aviation. Reconnaissance, artillery spotting, then bombing, then fighter combat. World War I compressed what might have been 30 years of peacetime development into about 4.
And the civilian side in those early years, what was it actually doing?
Barely hanging on. The interwar period is where the bifurcation really starts to take shape, but it's wildly lopsided. Military aviation is driving everything: speed records, engine reliability, instrument flying, radio navigation. The civilian side is this fragile experiment. Airmail subsidies kept it alive in the US. The post office basically underwrote the whole early airline industry. You've got barnstormers touring county fairs in surplus, Jenny biplanes. The first passenger routes were flown by ex-military pilots in converted bombers.
So the patterns that would eventually define civil aviation. Navigation, radio procedures, weather reporting, standardized checklists. Those were all forged in military contexts first.
And that's not an accident. The military had a problem that forced standardization. You can't run a bombing campaign if every pilot uses a different radio frequency or a different map coordinate system. The civilian side in the 20s and 30s was still operating on a kind of gentleman's agreement. You filed a flight plan if you felt like it, you landed in a field if the weather turned. The military had already learned the hard way that this kills people at scale.
Which sets up the question Daniel's really asking. What happens when civilian aviation grows big enough to need its own rules? And how does the relationship get formalized?
And the answer is a specific week in 1944. December 7th, to be precise, exactly 3 years after Pearl Harbor. While World War II is still raging, 52 nations sit down in Chicago and sign the Convention on International Civil Aviation. They create ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization. It's one of those moments where you can feel the adults deciding to build something before the war even ends, because they've seen what happens without it.
The date is almost 2 on the nose. Pearl Harbor anniversary, and they're writing the rules for the post-war sky.
I don't think it was coincidence. The war had demonstrated both the power of military aviation and the complete chaos of trying to coordinate anything across borders. Every nation had different standards for pilot licensing, different airworthiness requirements, different radio procedures. A plane that was legal to fly in France might be grounded in Britain for technical violations. The Chicago Convention was essentially saying, we need one rule book, and we need it before the commercial aviation boom that's clearly coming.
So walk me through what the convention actually built. What's the architecture?
3 pillars. First, the fundamental principle. Every state has complete and exclusive sovereignty over the airspace above its territory. That sounds obvious now, but it wasn't settled in 1944. There were serious proposals floating around for some kind of international freedom of the skies. The convention killed that. Your airspace is yours, period.
Which is why airlines need permission to overfly countries, even if they never land there.
Right. Second pillar, the convention established the right to overfly and make technical stops for non-scheduled flights. what became known as the First and Second Freedoms of the Air. Scheduled international service still required bilateral agreements, which is why we got the Bermuda Agreement and eventually Open Skies Treaties. But the basic framework was laid in Chicago.
And the third pillar is ICAO itself.
The permanent body. And this is where it gets interesting for Daniel's question. ICAO was given a specific mandate, develop international standards and recommended practices for civil aviation. Everything from pilot licensing to airworthiness to air traffic control to aeronautical telecommunications. They've now produced 19 annexes to the convention. Annex 1 is personnel licensing, Annex 10 is aeronautical telecommunications, and so on. These are the technical backbone of global civil aviation.
But here's the part that matters for this conversation. Article 3.
Article 3 is the firewall. It says, explicitly, that the convention applies only to civil aircraft, not to state aircraft. Military, customs, and police aircraft are completely exempt. They aren't subject to ICAO standards. The only obligation is that states shall have due regard for the safety of navigation of civil aircraft when operating state aircraft.
Due regard.
It's doing an enormous amount of work, and it's deliberately vague. The convention doesn't define what due regard means in operational terms. It doesn't specify procedures or coordination requirements. It just says, military aircraft, you do your thing, but please try not to hit any airliners.
Which is less a rule and more of a hope.
A legally binding hope. And that vagueness is actually the point. The drafters knew they couldn't tell sovereign militaries how to operate their aircraft. That was never going to fly, no pun intended, with the major powers in 1944. So they created a legal separation that gave civil aviation its own clean, standardized space while leaving the military completely outside the tent.
And that separation is what allowed civil aviation to become an industry at all.
This is the thing I think is underappreciated. Before the Chicago Convention, civil aviation was essentially a military-adjacent activity. The planes were military designs, the pilots were ex-military, the procedures were borrowed from military manuals. There was no independent civil aviation identity. ICAO created that identity by saying, here's a rules-based, predictable, internationally harmonized system that applies exclusively to civil operations. Airlines could now plan routes across continents knowing that the standards in Brazil would be the same as the standards in Belgium.
Because they're all working off the same annexes.
Same annexes, same licensing requirements, same radio phraseology, same airworthiness standards. A pilot certified under ICAO standards in one member state is recognized in all of them, with some bilateral variations, but the framework is there. That's what enabled the post-war explosion in commercial aviation. You couldn't have built a global airline industry on bilateral agreements alone. The transaction cost would have been insane.
So, the firewall is simultaneously what keeps the military out and what lets the civilians in.
That's a really clean way to put it. The exclusion of military aviation from ICAO's scope isn't a weakness of the system. It's the thing that made the system possible. If ICAO had tried to regulate military flights, the major powers would have walked away from the table. Instead, they carved out a civil-only space and let the military operate under national command with separate procedures.
But they're still sharing the same sky.
And that's where it gets operationally interesting. The firewall is a legal construct, but the airspace is a physical reality. Military aircraft and civil aircraft are in the same three-dimensional volume, and someone has to make sure they don't occupy the same point at the same time.
So, how does that actually work day to day?
Two main mechanisms. The first is segregated airspace, restricted zones, military training areas, warning areas over the ocean. The military gets chunks of sky that are off-limits to civil traffic, and civil controllers root around them. The second is dynamic coordination, what are called letters of agreement between civil air traffic control facilities and military bases. These spell out exactly how handoffs work, what frequencies to use, what separation standards apply, and what happens when something goes wrong.
The invisible choreography.
It really is invisible. A passenger on a 737 over the North Sea has no idea that there's a Typhoon fighter 20 miles away doing supersonic intercept training, and that the civil controller and the military controller are on a dedicated hotline making sure those two trajectories never intersect. The whole thing is running on procedures that the passenger will never see and never need to see.
And that works until it doesn't.
September 1st, 1983. Korean Airlines Flight 007, a 747 flying from Anchorage to Seoul, strays into Soviet airspace over the Kamchatka Peninsula. Soviet fighters intercept it. The pilots apparently don't realize they're off course. The autopilot was set incorrectly, and the crew didn't catch the deviation. The Soviet pilots fire two missiles. 269 people die.
That's the firewall failure in its starkest form.
It's the nightmare scenario the Chicago Convention was supposed to prevent, and it exposed the limits of due regard. The Soviet Union claimed the aircraft was on a spy mission. The international investigation found it was almost certainly a navigation error. But the core problem was that there was no mechanism to resolve the ambiguity in real time. The civil airliner was in military airspace. The military made a split-second call, and the firewall, which is supposed to prevent exactly this kind of catastrophic misunderstanding, turned out to be a line on a map, not a safety system.
And that incident changed things.
It did. After KAL-007, the international community made GPS available for civilian use. Reagan announced it'd be opened up precisely to prevent navigation errors of that kind. And ICAO tightened its standards around airspace incursion procedures. But the fundamental tension remained. Military aircraft operate under rules that prioritize mission success, and civil aircraft operate under rules that prioritize safety above everything. Those two logics are in constant tension, and the firewall is the thing that keeps them from grinding against each other.
Which brings us to the pattern Daniel identified. Military innovation feeds civilian aviation, but through a controlled channel. The firewall isn't just a barrier. It's also a transfer mechanism.
The jet engine, radar, GPS. All three were military programs first. The jet engine was developed for fighter aircraft in World War II. The Germans had the Mi-26-2 operational by 1944. Within a decade, the de Havilland Comet was carrying passengers across the Atlantic on jet power. Radar was a wartime air defense technology. By the 1950s, it was the backbone of civil air traffic control. GPS was built by the U.S. Department of Defense for missile guidance and troop navigation. Now, every airliner in the world depends on it.
And in each case, ICAO provided the channel for normalization.
The military develops the technology for military purposes. It proves itself in military operations. Then ICAO, through its annexes and standards, creates the framework for adopting that technology into civil aviation. Performance-based navigation standards, for example, are ICAO's way of saying, here's how you use GPS for civil approaches and departures, with the redundancy and integrity requirements that civil safety demands.
So the firewall isn't just keeping things apart. It's also a filter. Military stuff comes through, but only after it's been translated into civil terms.
And that translation step is crucial. A military GPS receiver doesn't need the same integrity guarantees as a civil one. If it fails, the mission is compromised, but hundreds of passengers don't die. Civil aviation requires a completely different safety case, and ICAO provides the standards that define what that safety case looks like. The technology crosses the firewall, but it gets re-specified for civil use.
Which brings us to the current test case. Drones.
UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, are the purest example of the pattern. Military drones have been operational for decades. The Predator first flew in 1994 as a reconnaissance platform, then got armed. Now there are thousands of military UAVs in service worldwide, from hand-launched tactical systems to high-altitude, long-endurance platforms that can stay airborne for days.
And now civil aviation wants in.
Wants in, and is already in ways that are testing the firewall like never before. You've got commercial drone delivery services, infrastructure inspection drones, agricultural spraying drones, and eventually, maybe, autonomous air taxis. All of these need to operate in the same airspace as manned civil aircraft, which means they need ICAO standards, but the technology is deeply entangled with military systems. The same drone platform might be used for crop dusting in Iowa and artillery spotting in Ukraine.
The dual-use problem.
It's not just the hardware, it's the airspace integration question. How do you fit a drone that doesn't have a pilot on board into an air traffic control system designed for human pilots making radio calls? ICAO is working on this. There's a whole remote pilot licensing framework in development. But the fundamental challenge is that drones blur the line the Chicago Convention drew so clearly in 1944.
Because a drone can be civilian one minute and military the next.
or both at once. The same airframe, the same ground control station, the same data link. The distinction between civil and state aircraft gets very fuzzy when the only difference is the mission software loaded that morning.
Which raises the question Daniel's really driving at. How integral has this distinction been? Could civil aviation have developed without it?
I think the answer is no, not at the scale we've seen. Without the Chicago Convention and the ICAO firewall, civil aviation would have remained what it was in the 1930s, a niche, military-adjacent activity, heavily subsidized, operating on bilateral deals that collapsed every time geopolitics shifted. The firewall gave civil aviation something it had never had before, an independent legal identity and a standardized global operating framework.
The numbers tell the story.
Pre-pandemic, civil aviation was carrying about 4.5 billion passengers a year. That's more than half the human population. The industry supports something like 65 million jobs globally and moves about a third of world trade by value. None of that happens without the predictability that ICAO standards provide. An airline in Singapore can buy a Boeing built in Seattle, register it in Ireland, hire pilots trained in Australia, and fly it to Brazil. And every piece of that chain works because everyone is operating under the same annexes.
But the firewall also created a kind of institutional blindness. The military operates in its own world, the civilians in theirs, and they only talk to each other when they have to.
That's the cultural dimension, and it's real. Civil controllers and military controllers have fundamentally different mindsets. Civil aviation is safety first. Every decision is about risk reduction, separation assurance, procedural compliance. Military aviation is mission first, safety matters, but it's subordinate to the operational objective. When those two cultures have to coordinate in real time, the friction is significant.
Different radio frequencies, different terminology, different assumptions about what urgent means.
Different chains of command. A civil controller can't order a military pilot to do anything. They can request, they can advise, they can declare an emergency. But the military pilot answers to a military chain of command that may have priorities the civil controller doesn't know about and wouldn't be clear to know about.
The firewall is simultaneously the thing that made civil aviation possible and the thing that creates its most dangerous failure modes.
That's the paradox at the heart of Daniel's question. The system works brilliantly almost all the time. Millions of flights a year, military and civil sharing the same sky, and catastrophic failures are extraordinarily rare. But when the firewall fails, it fails hard, and the consequences are measured in hundreds of lives.
Before we wrap up, Hilbert's been sitting on something. He's got a story about this firewall that might change how you think about it.
Late 80s, Vance Air Force Base in Oklahoma. Joint use field, military primary, but we ran civil traffic through it too. I was on the civil side of the control room.
Wait, you were an air traffic controller?
3 years. Before that, I drove a forklift at a bottling plant. The FAA was hiring anyone who could pass the aptitude test. The firewall you're talking about, it wasn't a legal document to us. It was a red line painted on the radar screen. Civil airspace on this side, military on that side. The military controller sat 6 feet to my left. We had a standing bet, $20, on who could vector a plane closer to the line without triggering a violation.
That sounds inadvisable.
Closest I ever got was 0.3 miles. He beat me once at 0.2. We paid out in cash at the end of the shift. Nobody ever filed paperwork on it because nobody ever crossed the line. The bet was about precision, not recklessness.
The firewall was a game to you.
The firewall was real because we made it real. The legal stuff from Chicago didn't mean anything at 3 in the morning when you've got a C-130 doing touch-and-goes and a Delta flight descending through 10,000 feet. What mattered was that the guy next to you knew his procedures and you knew yours, and you trusted each other enough to make it work.
When that trust broke down...
Had a T-38 come through one night? Trainer jet, 2 seats, young pilot, and an instructor. They were doing emergency landing practice. The military controller cleared them into the civil pattern without telling me. I've got a 727 on final approach, and suddenly a T-38 appears on my scope where nothing should be.
What happened?
I vectored the 727 around. The T-38 landed. Nobody hit anybody. But the paperwork took 3 weeks. The real problem, the thing nobody writes down, was that the T-38 pilot couldn't hear me on his radio. Different frequencies. He had no idea I was talking to the airliner he was about to share a runway with. The military controller assumed I'd see the handoff on my scope, but the handoff never happened in my system. The computers didn't talk to each other.
The firewall was literally two systems that couldn't communicate.
Still is, in a lot of places. The legal firewall creates an operational gap, and the operational gap gets bridged by two people in a room who've worked together long enough to know what the other one's going to do before he does it. When you replace one of those people with someone new, or when the computers don't pass the data, the bridge collapses.
That's the cultural dimension you can't legislate.
The Chicago Convention says, "Do regard." What it means is, hope the controllers like each other. Most of the time they do. When they don't, or when the system doesn't let them, you get KAL-007. I cashed that $20 and bought a round at a bar off base. The military controller, guy named Kowalski, told me the T-38 incident was the third one that month at that base. Said the Air Force had a saying, the firewall works because both sides pretend the other doesn't exist until they have to talk to each other, and then it's a mess.
Kowalski sounds like a philosopher.
Kowalski owned 4 snowmobiles and lived in a trailer. He was no philosopher, but he understood the system better than the people who designed it.
That's a hell of a story. The question it leaves hanging is whether the firewall can survive what's coming. Drones, autonomous systems, air taxis, all of these blur the line the Chicago Convention drew so cleanly. A drone doesn't care whether it's civil or military. The software does both.
The current geopolitical environment isn't making it easier. You've got Iranian-backed proxies targeting Saudi Arabia, a widening conflict in the Middle East, NATO-style defense pacts forming. The military side of aviation is more active than it's been in decades, and it's operating in airspace that civil traffic also needs to use.
The bifurcation was never a natural state. It was a deliberate construction, built in a specific week in 1944 by people who just watched aviation nearly destroy the world and wanted to make sure it could also connect it. That construction held for 80 years. Whether it holds for another 80 is genuinely open.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the show running, and apparently for keeping airplanes separated over Oklahoma.
If you've got a weird prompt, send it to us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll turn it into an episode. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.